Geography. Free space for geography. Extending teaching and learning methods beyond the boundaries of campus.
Did you hear about Frontline?
Frontline,
by the way, has an outstanding production.
Geography Frontline.
Hey, Frontliners, another week has gone and Frontline is gaining subscribers constantly. So, welcome everybody to the show. All new listeners and all existing Frontliners. How's it going today, If you take a look at the news these days, Queen Elizabeth Jubilee is all over the news, right? But there's more going on. This week, Euro 2012 will start. The football, Americans might call it soccer, the football tournament, to become the best European team. Yeah. Germany might have a good chance for winning this year. And yeah, Spain is always hard to beat, and there are many more great players around that might be good for a surprising outcome of Euro 2012. And because Euro 2012 is starting this Friday, we should really talk a little more about, yeah, today's topic, Euro 2012. Do you really think that the Euro 2012 is all about soccer? That people from all over Europe meet in Poland and Ukraine to watch some good sports? And that's it? You could take a social geographic stand and look at people's behavior, of course, on the way to the stadium, inside the stadium, the different kinds of reasons why they go to watch soccer, and so on. And all this is described by Roger Bacher's behavior setting theory. Yeah. But you could also watch the Euro 2012 from another economic geographic point of view. And this is what we're going to do today. Great sport events really have the potential not only to move a large number of fans, but also to transform the economic situation in a country or city, to be more precise. The Barcelona effect is economist speak for the long-term benefits of hosting a sport event which offers a window on the world. In Barcelona's case, it was the 1992 Olympic Games, preparations for which saw a massive refurbishment drive and major infrastructure projects. While the city was already on the tourist circuit, the number of visitors climbed before the Games and continued to do so as it became a magnet. Yeah, and that's from a website called eubusiness.com and tells us how important sport events can be. Let's go on reading. Euro 2012 marks the first edition of Europe's top international tournament behind the former Iron Curtain, a region not necessarily a first choice for would-be tourists. From 700,000 to 1 million fans are expected in Poland during Euro 2012, which kicks off on June 8th and are tipped to spend 844 million zloty. Okay, what's that all about? That's okay, here's the number. 193 million euros or $246 million. Wow. But their presence could have a long-term impact if they enjoy themselves and spread the word, helping along with an intensive PR campaign to pull Poland up the ladder of global perception rankings. So, Frontliners, it's all about perception, right? All about perception. What do you think when you think about Poland or the Ukraine? Ask yourselves and watch some reports on the country while the tournament takes place. You might get surprised. See something you would never thought of Poland looks like. But what are the economic effects are supposed to be? Euro 2012 related investment over the last 4 years amounted to 25 billion euros in Poland and 11 billion euros in Ukraine, at respectively 1.3% and 1.7% of gross domestic product each year. Those figures were much greater as a share of GDP than is usually the case with similar sporting events. Polish authorities have said that the tournament will create up to 60,000 jobs, equal to 0.4% of the labor force. Based on that estimate, Capital Economics predicted that new jobs in Ukraine as a result of hosting Euro 2012 could be equivalent to 1% of the workforce, a significant amount of job creation. Hey, 1% of the workforce? That's amazing! That's amazing! If you believe what publicserviceeurope.com is writing. So it seems like this sport event might really be a gift, right, for Polish and Ukrainian economy. But what about the rest of the EU? Does the European Union also benefit from Euro 2012? What do you think? Let's read from the ABN AMRO. Yeah, ABN AMRO, that's the bank. Let's read from their report called Soccernomics 2012. And there they say, from a confident perspective, one of the Eurozone countries would ideally win Euro 2012. A victory for one of the Euro opt-outs like Denmark, England or Sweden would not be welcome, because it would only encourage the Eurosceptics. Funny, huh? And that leaves the question of whether it would be better for one of the core countries like Germany, France or the Netherlands to win, or one of the peripheral countries. The contagion has already spread to the periphery, and a range of measures have been introduced to support these countries, right? Like, think about Greece. So we feel it is essential that the contagion does not spread to the core countries. So let's hope that, yeah, all this crisis we are in right now in the European Union, that it doesn't get worse, and so therefore the core countries like Germany, France, the Netherlands have to be strong and remain strong, right? Okay. So, of the participating core countries, France is closest to the firing line. Yeah, they're not in a really good shape, let's put it like this. And on the assumption that a victory would provide a confidence boost, it would be best if France won Euro 2012. What? Come on! Hey guys, can you believe it? France to win the Euro 2012 would be best for Europe economically? Isn't that... Oh, I was 1 second away of saying insane. Isn't that interesting? But you know what? In the end, I think this report, Soccernomics report from ABN AMRO, it's a great report, a really great one. Why? Yeah, because you can also find the following prediction in it. So, 2 years ago, we accurately predicted that Spain would win the World Cup, and as they say in the world of football, never change a winning team. Even so, we have slightly adjusted our prediction method. Our current predictive indicators use the all-time European Championship rankings, the FIFA rankings, and a form ranking. On the basis of these indicators, Germany and Spain are closely matched, followed at some distance by the Netherlands. Not least given the form trend, we believe that Germany will win Euro 2012. I'm really beginning to love bankers. So, yeah, let's sum it up, frontliners, this whole topic with a quick vote. Will Euro 2012 impact the European economy? Answer A. Of course it will. Answer B. I don't think so. Answer C. Well, not sure. Could be. Or answer D, another opinion.
What's that sound?
It's time again to sensitize ourselves for the auditive elements within the urban landscape. Every week we listen to a sound caused by something you have probably heard several times before in your lives. But the problem with urban sound is you usually don't pay too much attention to them. And as you can only use things for your empirical fieldwork, for example, you already know this section of the show tries to open up this auditive field for us. So, to make us even better observers. And last week's sound riddle sounded like this. What do you think? Was a little hard to guess, right? So, geographer did what you should always do after listening to the sound riddle. Send an email to comment@geography.com with your guess on the sound source. And to get more people commenting on the sound riddle, we even have a competition going on, right? For 5 correct answers, you win a Frontline t-shirt, available on the Geography website in the subsection shop. So go to geography.com to check out the latest designs. But coming back to Geographer's email, he says, wow, this one is hard. It sounds like a whisk in an empty metal bowl. Kind regards, Geographer. Hey, sad but true. He was the only frontliner responding to the sound riddle. Frontliners, and this really has to change, right? So help me out here. So this sound is not a whisk in an empty metal bowl. Too bad. Too bad. So to give you a hint, it is something you can hear outside in the streets. And try to solve the sound riddle and gain a point for your free t-shirt. So let's take a break with Soccer Mom. Don't make a bone, she doesn't even wear base. Her bedroom hair falls just right on her face. Looking good, she's filling out her old jeans. She's loved by everybody on the team. She wears her pride like a jersey. Not afraid to get a little dirty. Drives her kids from here to there and everywhere. I don't think she's wearing any underwear. She brings the snacks and oranges to every game. Her sweet smile stimulates the team's flame. Shows us all how to win at life and in love. Not afraid to mix a little push and shove. With the kids, I think she sucks it cool. All the dads fall for her and act a fool. And the wives are watching with a snake eye. Man on dogs, we ain't got no alibi. She's the bomb. A great, awesome song for all soccer fans. Soccer Mom from Olio's album Living the Dream. Available on the PodSafe Music Network on music.mivio.com. Download the whole album or song only on iTunes. Links to the US and German version of it are, as always, in the show notes. We really have to catch up on some quick votes, frontliners. During the last episodes, we had several of them still running and to get more diverse sets of answers, right? So let's start with the first one out of these three. Can society really change the economy today? That was the question, and here are the results. Of course it can, because... said 67% of the frontliners. I'm not sure if it can, because nobody voted for that. Or answer C, no way, it can't, because... also, no answer. And another opinion, yeah, that's 33%. And among these 33%, you can find the opinion, the other opinion of geographer. He says, can society really change the economy today? Yes. No. Maybe. I don't really know. So I voted on another opinion. Well, aren't customers part of the society? And if they were, don't they influence the economy every day? This would mean today's economy is based on several influences through society. Is it a real change to move from product A to product B, as told before? Or is it only a change when a new product replaces an old one? And not only a new product, but also a new company with new ideas and a new image. However, they have to compete with the big companies that already exist. Okay, geographer, to make some comments on your thoughts, I'd like to say something about the customers. Of course, they are the society. If customers decide to buy another product, if there is the need within the society for such a new product, then this might change a whole industry, of course. And but I'll come back to that in a minute. He goes on and says... newly created products are more expensive than those products made by mass production. Yeah, granted. When people know about the new product and can afford it, they might change their shopping behavior and, with this final step, the economy. Would it be a change by society? Doesn't this take for granted that there is something like a social opinion? And who creates such an opinion? Social opinion, advertisements, the government, the media, social media. Who is behind behind it? Who is the author behind it? Who benefits from this change? Maybe in small scale, you find some little changes made by the society. In bigger scales, you will find changes made by a few people and a lot of followers, different from society. Like, think about regional food, he says, to give you an example. People accepted regional food as a new brand, and they buy it because it's regional, it's from our home. And he added two hearts here. Okay, lovely. Who wanted that change? Maybe local farmer associations? I'm not really sure if this was a change by society with its social opinion. I think it's more about marketing strategies and advertisement. Who is orchestrating that people buy new things? What do you think, frontliners? Is it society or the industry with its marketing? I don't know. I think it's both. Might be both. Depends. If you talk about marketing and advertisements, who comes up with the idea for a new product in the first place? Maybe it was a survey, right? Customers ask what they might want from a new product. So the result of people's needs would be reflected in new products marketed to sell it or these products even more to more people, right? I really can't help myself and think about Apple. And there was one great comment about Apple's success, arguing that Apple would not relate on customers' needs. Apple would create something new people never had, and they never had an idea that they would need it, like the iPad. There was no real need for some device like the iPad between the smartphone and the laptop. Innovation, the comment said, would only be possible if you'd stop listening to what customers want and just innovate by something they then realize would be a must-have. Yeah, that they would realize that they would want an iPad. Never thought of an iPad before. I know everybody wants to have one. And yeah, in the case of these iPads, I'd argue that this kind of use of the internet and mobile services, including social media, the ways how you use your iPad had a big impact on society that turns into a more mobile one and therefore requests all kinds of new things for this new, more mobile life. Does that make any sense? On the other hand, you could ask, how must the society be shaped to be open to this new technologies like the ones in the iPad? Could this have happened some 20 years ago? Or has society already changed and was simply waiting, maybe without even waiting for the iPad? Businessinsider.com. That's a nice website. They released an interesting article on June 3rd called Don't Mean to Be Alarmist, but the TV business may be starting to collapse, saying this user behavior has been changing for a while, and so far it has had almost no impact on the TV business. On the contrary, the networks and cable companies are still fat and happy, and they are coining more and more money every year. But remember what happened in the newspaper business. And in this marvelous analysis, you can read about users' behavior versus the features of current products, the failure of the newspaper industry, and the possible decline of television like we know it now, nowadays. And if this analysis, I'll put a link to it into the show notes so you could have a read. If this analysis should come true, you could turn it all around and say maybe even inventions like the iPad are not shaping society. Maybe society has already changed, and by this change only made possible the enormous success of a product like the iPad. Think about that. Next in line, second quick vote, is about noise exposure maps. We really have to catch up. So a lot of quick votes in this episode. Remember we talked about the need for such noise exposure maps and discussed the missing data from many cities in the United States of A? Here are the results for the question. Do we really need noise exposure maps? Answer A. Yes, they contain important information. 60%. Answer B. No, qualitative elements are missing, said 40% of the listeners. Yeah, and we don't have any other comments, and to keep it a little shorter, because for the next one we do have a comment, let's jump right in into the third quick vote and the last one for today's show. Stereotypes in children's books. Yeah, last but not least, this quick vote of last episode's topic. stereotypes in children's books. Hey, important. They are important, these stereotypes, to understand the world. Say 50% of the frontliners. Answer B. Stereotypes in children's books are racist and totally outdated. 25% of the frontliners. And another opinion, also 25%. And while the majority of frontliners think that stereotypes in children's books are important to understand the world, Steffen posted another opinion that is really interesting. He says, in my opinion, stereotypes reflect a certain spirit of the time, Zeitgeist. What gives them some importance to understand society, but not the world. More importantly, stereotypes reflect the view of ourselves on others, of individuals or whole societies on others, which we find, for example, in Orientalism, exotism, etc. It leads to classification and could even lead to discrimination. They are very often used to express predominance or to manifest certain roles, what makes them dangerous, referring to gender. Thus, I think we always need to observe and critically discuss the development of stereotypes. And you know what, Steffen? I love this answer. It for sure is absolutely important to keep an eye on stereotypes used in media and the ones we use ourselves, right? And the Zeitgeist issue is a big one. Of course, you always want to have to keep that in mind when stumbling over stereotypes. Think about, let's say, the descriptions of Humboldt's voyage in the Americas in 1799. We talked about that last show, about his mentioning race and operating with that term. But we'll talk about that in a second. Stereotypes help us to structure the world, like Steffen says. Or he says, like, helps us to structure society. I don't know why you make that difference here between world and society, but I'd say it really doesn't matter. So, but okay. Stereotypes help us to structure the world or society. The view of ourselves on others. And if the picture of the alien, to put it in other words, if the picture of the alien is too vague, too foggy, too unclear, then you end up with your own identity being less sharp and more vague, right? And I'm not saying that the world is painted in black and white, or not that I would prefer it to be like this. I'm just saying that by using stereotypes and generalization, it makes it easier to understand what's going on around us. You might also call it the human limit of perception. I don't know. But one thing has to be clear. If we understand the world not as an objective entity, but an individual one, or better, a social construction, that stereotypes indeed help us to understand the world, because we thus understand society in the same way. Does that make any sense to you? Talking about stereotypes, I just said it. There are a lot of those stereotypes to be found in Humboldt's personal narratives. And in every episode of Geography Frontline, we continue our reading of Humboldt's voyage to the Americas in 1799 and try to get inspired and learn from his skills as an observer and as a geographer, of course. So last week, we talked about the use of the term race and the colonization of South America. So let's continue. The town of Cumana, properly so called, occupies the ground lying between the castle of San Antonio, and the small rivers of Manzanares and Santa Catalina. The delta, formed by the bifurcation of the first of these rivers, is a fertile plain covered with mames, zapotas, that's acres, plantains, and other plants cultivated in the gardens or charas of the Indians. The town has no remarkable edifice, and the frequency of earthquakes forbids such establishments. So we learn about Cumana, this city they landed at a few episodes frontline ago. So the city lies in an earthquake zone and therefore does not or have any huge or more fragile buildings. But what does Hummel base this theory on? What do you think? Earthquakes means no tall buildings? He goes on and says, it is true that strong shocks occur less frequently in a given time at Cumana than at Quito, where we nevertheless find sumptuous and very lofty churches. Okay, frontliners, I think we got him. What do you think? While in Cumana there are no tall buildings, in Quito there are, and there are earthquakes too. So should Humboldt lose his observation skills? And draw the wrong conclusions? Could this ever be possible? But the earthquakes of Quito, okay, here it comes. But the earthquakes of Quito are violent only in appearance, and from the peculiar nature of the motion and of the ground, no edifice there is overthrown. At Cumana, as well as at Lima, and in several cities situated far from the mouth of burning volcanoes, it happens that the series of slight shocks is interrupted after a long course of years by great catastrophes resembling the effects of the explosion of a mine. We shall have occasion to return to this phenomenon, for the explanation of which so many vain theories have been imagined and which have been classified according to perpendicular and horizontal movements, shock and oscillation. I see. There is a difference in ground and the motion. And Humboldt mentions the location. These endangered location in cities like Cumana, they are too far or far away from the volcanoes. And what does that mean? What does that exactly mean? And if you think about it from a like geomorphological point of view, it could say or could guess that the movements of the continents and the landmass collisions and subduction zones play some kind of important role for that. That you would always have these earthquakes in a certain distance of volcanoes, right? You know that, remember? And I think it again, it's amazing what kind of broad knowledge Humboldt has. Wow. Every week it really blows me away. And the announcements for today's episode 128 of Geography Frontline are for Heritage 2012, the third International Conference on Heritage and Sustainable Development, taking place June 19th to 22nd, 2012, in Porto, Portugal. On their website, they say, Heritage 2012 aims at establishing a state-of-the-art event regarding the relationships between forms and kinds of heritage and the framework of sustainable development concepts. Environment, economics, society, and culture, the four dimensions of sustainable development, are brought here to define a singular approach on how to deal and go beyond the traditional aspects of heritage preservation and safeguarding. On our today's world, heritage is no longer just a memory or a cultural reference or even a place or an object. Heritage is moving towards broader and wider scenarios, where it becomes often the driving forces for commerce, business, leisure, and politics. So Heritage 2012 Third International Conference on Heritage and Sustainable Development is proposed to be a global view on how heritage is being contextualized in relation with the four dimensions of sustainable development, what is being done in the terms of research, future directions, methodologies, working tools, and other significant aspects of both theoretical and field approaches will be the aims of this international conference. Yeah, heritage. Yeah, that's a topic we talked about for quite some time now, right? So I think that this conference might be interesting for you. And by the way, Porto, that's really worth a visit. Great fish, great fado music, and great wine. Yeah, to use some common stereotypes for Portugal, of course. So whenever you hear this tune, you know that Frontline has come to an end. I think you should spend some thoughts on the economic impact of your 2012 and your daily stereotypes. And are you going to watch some soccer over the next weeks? I will, for sure. Whatever you do, Frontliners, have a great week. And say it with me now. The network is us.